All to today's audio conference workshop, which is entitled Faith-Based Community Development, An Exciting Call to Servanthood for Christians in Social Work. It's going to be presented by Marty Koistra, who's the Content and Knowledge Manager at Free Humanity University. Today's audio conference will provide a brief overview of faith-based community development, including exploring key concepts of community development and what makes communities healthy and whole. In addition, this audio conference will look at effective models of faith-based community development and evaluate a variety of indicators of success. Finally, it will challenge participants to find ways to build community in their own respective locales. As we mentioned, today's session will be delivered by NACSW member Marty Koistra, who's been with Habitat for Humanity for a number of years in various positions. They've included Senior Affiliate Support Manager, Regional Director, and then also Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity at Greater Sioux Falls. Just before we begin our session, let me quickly cover a few important housekeeping items. First of all, after this general introduction, and for most of the conference today, we'll be using a muting function to eliminate background noise. I'm sure you can already hear the dogs barking and the trucks passing by for those of you on cell phones, and we find that by muting you out for most of the time, you'll actually be able to hear Marty without having to strain. But at different intervals, he'll ask for the muting function to be taken off, and we'll enter a live mode where there'll be the possibility of questions and answers. Our request is that anything at that point in your background can be heard by the whole group, so do whatever you can to keep the background noise to an absolute minimum. Secondly, during the question and answer periods, do try to keep your questions and comments crisp. We have a fairly large audience. And again, just the courtesy of making sure we give everyone the opportunity to speak who wants a chance. And then lastly, we invite you to follow the outline which he's provided and that we posted on our website. And you can get there by following the link that we provided previously. If for some reason you have difficulty accessing the outline, let me know via email, and I'll send you a copy either as we're speaking or immediately after today's session. And so without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, Marty Koistra. If you can give me just a minute, Marty, to go into mute mode, we'll be set to go.
Very good. Thank you, Rick. I hope everyone can hear me. It's great to be here with you and to have this opportunity. It's also exciting to see the folks at NACSW taking seriously this role of the social work profession in engaging in community work. My social work background goes back to days at Dort College in Sioux Center, Iowa, where I got a BSW. And I recall the challenge in engaging in more macro practice work because there weren't a lot of opportunities, first of all, for field placement and internships. But secondly, the priority seemed to be focused more on micro practice issues. This, however, is near and dear unto my heart. Just a little bit more about myself before we get into the content, and we will be relying heavily on the presentation, so hopefully, as Rick said, if you aren't able to get it from the URL he provided in HTML format, let him know, and he will email it to you via a PowerPoint presentation that you could download and print in that way as well. I grew up in a small town in northwest Iowa, and spent most of my energetic life doing construction work. For 7 years, I ran my own construction business, and then went on to college and got a degree in social work and sociology, and from there ended up moving into the realm of Habitat, and as Rick mentioned, a number of roles, 14 years now. And it's been a good learning experience for me to address my passions and beliefs in how we as Christians walk here on earth and what we should be doing. The issue of community is near and dear unto my heart, and as you can see as we go through this, it's something that will be a focus of what you'll be hearing from me both here and if you come to the conference in D.C. There's a whole track actually being done on community development there where there will be another presentation and hopefully in the future more and more on this topic. So with that in mind, let's move into the actual material, and the agenda will be we'll go through three topics and stop after each one for some Q&A or other remarks that people have. certainly I know there are folks on this call who bear a tremendous amount of expertise and experience in this field, and if we can, in the time we're allotted, we'll try to tap into that. And I'm certainly going to encourage everyone to continue the dialogue afterwards. We can connect via email or a number of other technological ways to keep things moving forward from here. Let's take a look, if you have in front of you your material, briefly on slide number 5. I just want to make a couple of comments. Where I am right now is physically at Harvard. I am in the Joint Center for Housing Studies, and I'm on a 3-month sabbatical from Habitat with a Bush Fellowship, studying primarily community capacity and competence as it relates to affordable housing. But since being here, I got here about the second week of September, I've been inundated with a whole new realm of content and material and thought and being intellectually stimulated. And so I consider what you're about to experience very much a work in progress, because what I'm finding is there's a whole lot more to be mined and unearthed in the field, and still some things that we don't know. There is not a lot of information out there on what we'll call pure faith-based community development, if we use a housing and urban development definition of that, and we'll talk more about that, especially in terms of measuring impact. And I'm hoping that we can open up a whole new realm of understanding and research in this area in the future. So that said, let's get into some definitions and concepts, and if you have your slides in front of you, slide 6 is just a little funny thing I stuck in there to basically say, I know you want to get to the meat of things, but bear with me, we're going to build a framework first, and the scaffolding will be kind of these definitions and concepts that we're going to go through. First one, what is community? And let's look at just briefly some biblical perspectives. And I would hope while we're doing this that your mind is prompted to think of any kind of references or experiences you have that really come to mind that reflect on community. I know the Old Testament, if you review especially the book of Leviticus, there's a lot of material in the work and the prophets that kind of point us to what community is about, and justice issues and caring for the needs of others. And so I've stuck in your presentation just 2 small examples, the first being from the book of Psalms 107, and the second being from Acts chapter 2, which is a New Testament kind of rendition of the power of the Spirit working in the lives of people to build community from a relationship perspective. Now we'll move to slide number 9, what is community? And there is a lot of definitions out there, as you know, on what is community. I just tried to pick 2 ways of looking at it here that are very similar. And the first coming from Philip Fellin's book, The Community and the Social Worker, which happened to be my favorite text when I was going through my BSW work. And it says, a community exists when a group of people form a social unit based on common location, interest, identification, and some common combination of these characteristics. So then that leads us to say there's 3 major types of communities. Those with geographic boundaries that are distinguished by locality or place. Those created and maintained through identification and interest, such as communities based on ethnicity, culture, race, religion, lifestyle, sexual orientation, social class, occupation, etc., etc. And then thirdly, those distinguished by an overlap of geographical location with identification or interest. If you move to the next slide, 10, another way to put it, taking this from Suzanne Morris's book, which was just released, she works for the Pew Leadership folks, called Smart Communities. Community is a term that is used very specifically on the one hand and casually on the other, very true, but it involves around 3 nexuses: the community of relationships, the community of interests, and the community of place. And so, I'd like us to try to use that simplicity as we move forward in this thing, there being relationships, interest, and place. Some attributes of good community. Just a quote here from Wilma Mankiller. I think a healthy community is one where people are not just out for themselves, and they are not just working on their individual pursuits, but where they understand their relationship and responsibility to other people. What are some desirable attributes of community? And I just pulled out here a couple of quotes for you from David Gushee's book, Toward a Just and Caring Society, and find these to be helpful. And this takes us back to the conversation about social justice in the Old Testament. The first being, persons are created for community. Scriptures understand the good life as sharing in the essential aspects of social life. Therefore, justice includes restoration to community. Justice includes helping people return to the kind of life and community which God intends for them. The concern is for the whole person and what it takes to maintain persons in that relationship. And then community membership means the ability to share fully within one's capacity and potential in each essential aspect. And we're talking here about everything, decision-making, social life, et cetera, as well as having one's physical and material needs met. And a key role there, looking at the decent life. So, having gone through that, let's take the next leap here into what is community development. And I'm going to have us wrestle through not only what is community development, but the term community building and a bit about community organizing, and see if we can come up with some sense, at least, of where I'm wrestling through these definitions and where I think it can be helpful. The Wilder Foundation tells us that the community development definitions tend to share, you know, the common elements of process, bringing people together, so to speak, to change the quality of life, and other definitions involve the process of building networks and improving the capacity of individuals and organizations. And then there are others that focus on improvements within the community without necessarily working on the relationship building aspect. The definition you have at the bottom of page 13 comes from a HUD report, Faith-Based Organizations in Community Development, which I believe Rick sent you the link for. The link is also included in this presentation that you can download. And it is, community development is asset building, centers around housing and community economic development, but also includes developmental efforts such as job training to prepare residents for more productive lives. Interestingly enough, if you take a holistic approach and view of community development, it's ironic that many organizations end up starting off with or focusing on housing as their core issue, because there is a number of other things, as you know, that need to be taking place, not just housing. In Habitat for Humanity, we've learned this both the hard way and the long way in terms of just creating a place for someone, a house, in a dysfunctional neighborhood or in a neighborhood in a community that doesn't thrive or meet someone, the rest of someone's needs, does not necessarily provide a solution. But economic development seems to be much more difficult and harder to get into, and I think that's one of the reasons why we see organizations and entities gravitating towards the kind of intrinsic value they can get from doing housing. Let's move on to community building then, and there's some definitions you see there on page 14. Community building generally refers to building the social networks within the community and developing group and individual problem solving and leadership skills. Wilder says their definition is any identifiable set of activities pursued by a community in order to increase community social capacity. And then there's just a couple other definitions I've provided there. Practice of building connections and concern strengthening the capacity of neighborhood residents, et cetera, to collectively, individually and collectively, to foster and sustain positive neighborhood change. And then we'll take the next step, is what is community organizing? referring to the process of bringing community members together and providing them with tools to help themselves. Community organizing is a strategy for building communities and for community development. Perhaps best known is the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is the work of Saul Alinsky for a number of years in the community organizing field. Now, let me just qualify something at this stage. It's interesting when you read about how some people view community organizing in its relationship to community development. There are some views and perspectives that believe that community organizing as a strategy does not necessarily foster true community development because it's kind of an in-your-face, up front kind of behavior that may not work on the relationship side or may not be sustainable. It certainly, as we have seen in a number of cases, has an upfront impact, an immediate impact of change, but whether or not folks appreciate the style and the nature and the way it goes about doing things and whether that's sustainable is questionable. And I'll leave that to your experience and research to kind of flesh out, but it is an interesting dynamic. Slide 16, what I've done here is tried to just obfuscate things for you by saying if you want to have some fun, go on the internet and type in community development, and you'll get inundated with definitions of what people say community development is. There's a lot of them, and there's just a small sampling there on that page. Let's pick it up on 17 then. So confusing is all of this talk about community. For me, to sort through all of that, this is kind of how I have come to terms with it, and we'll see if this helps you at all. Community development might be seen as overall activities and interventions that enhance the relationships of members, which respect and leverage the interests represented there within that community, that transform the place through housing, economic, and workforce development, and have the goal of improving the quality of life. Community organizing and community development may be viewed as aspects of or methods to do community development. See if that helps you a bit. And there's just a few more definitions and concepts I'd like to take up at this point. And then we'll stop and let folks ask any questions or provide comments and feedback at that point. I'm going to slide 19 now, if you have it in front of you. What is community capacity? And 20 is community competence. And these are things that I find to be extremely important, especially in the work that Habitat for Humanity is doing. We, just to bring it home a bit, we have a model where we try to replicate this affiliate community model around the country and around the world. We're now in 1,700 locations in the United States, 90 countries overall, building roughly 17,000 houses a year using volunteers and community folk. But the notion that we can take and look at performance and the ability to generate productivity purely based on organizational capacity has become a real challenge. And what I've been saying all along is we need to take a look at what are the indicators of capacity that the community has and the competence that the community has and mesh that with our organizational capacity issues to find out what really the carrying focus, the ability of the community to solve its affordable housing issues are. And it's going to require a much different approach than purely just building units. It's all about collaboration, engaging in the community, advocacy, education, and so forth, as many of you well know. But capacity and competence of the community, I think, are key central points in this area. And I've chosen two definitions or explanations of these concepts coming from the Foundations of Social Work Practice book that I've inserted here. On the capacity side, refers to the characteristics of communities that affect their ability to identify, mobilize, and act to resolve community issues and concerns. key dimensions include participation in leadership, access to and wise use of resources. And incidentally, it's my view that every community has resources. For a number of years, I was doing work in South Dakota on the Native American reservations there. And there are many stories of situations where we continue to unearth and find and mine resource potential and resource possibilities. And a lot of folks have the impression that certain communities just don't have resources. And I prefer to look at it from a different perspective and say, I know there's resources there. The question is are we able to help support the community in utilizing those and leveraging those resources? Social and interorganizational networks, a sense of community. Again, now there's an interesting way to see the word used after our definitions. It's kind of been parked in the middle of this thing, a sense of community. Community history of collective action, community power, shared core values, and capacity to engage in critical reflection. Maybe just briefly a little bit about where I grew up. I grew up in a town of 700 people. And I remember as a child, the decision was made that our community would have a outdoor heated swimming pool. Now, this probably tells you how old I am, but it was very interesting and exciting for us as kids to think, wow, we're going to have a swimming pool in our community, and it's going to be heated nonetheless. And it took 3.5 years, mind you, for this little town for us to generate the money to buy the materials, to utilize volunteers to build this swimming pool. So there was this huge thermometer plopped up on the street corner, hanging on one of the street lights, that someone would go with red paint and paint new marks every time we'd done a fundraiser or somebody'd made a gift and finally had enough money to say, we can go ahead and do this. And it's indicative of a community that has the capacity to bring people together. That same community for now 50 years has done a celebration on the 4th of July. 700 people in the community, 10,000 folks show up on the 4th of July every year to experience the vibrant celebration that they have, and it's known throughout the area as being the place to go. So there's a capacity there. Now, there are downsides to that community, and I'm not going to elaborate on what those are, but you can see that when people come together with shared values and some collective action and leadership, they can accomplish significant things. On the competence side, we're looking more at things that involve activities that strengthen investment and commitment, clarification of issues and interests, development of the ability of community members to articulate views, attitudes, needs, and intentions, enhancement of communication skills, and this one is so immensely critical in today's society where we have a number of different groups and factions and issues represented, and the ability for us to communicate openly and safely and respectfully along those lines are essential for problem-solving things to take place. The ability to negotiate differences and manage conflict, and then participation from the membership. And then finally, the question of assets and deficits, and I'm sure that all of you have confronted or heard about, you know, the different paradigms that we have in terms of should we focus on the needs of the community, or should we focus first on the strengths and the assets of the community? And I chose to put a clipboard on there as a little icon, if you can see that or if you have it printed out, because of the tendency for us to have our checklists mentally or physically of saying, you know, these are the things that you should have, and let me run around and see if you've got them or not. And if I identify that you don't, that means it's a need or a deficit, and I'm going to develop a way to correct that. And you know, I think that many of us are finding, whether we're doing family strengthening kinds of work or community work, that starting off with assets and really looking at those can help change the frame of reference and help us determine what we can work with to leverage what the community has in its terms of its capacity and its competence to change. for the better. Just yesterday, I'm visiting a church here called Old Cambridge Baptist Church, and they have a huge old building that's kind of a deep black hole in for them financially. So they've taken all the pews out of this church and turned the whole thing into a huge dance studio. And on Sunday mornings, they throw down some chairs and a pulpit and have church in there. But it's a revenue-generating stream for them in order to keep the facility going and the church alive. They had been involved in doing an overnight shelter when the weather got below 10 degrees below zero. They offered some rooms in their basement as a shelter for folks off the street here in Cambridge. Well, that program didn't necessarily work out real well, but yesterday during their congregational meeting, I was observing they were wrestling with the issue of what should their ministry to those who are homeless be. And ironically, the conversation came up, well, we need to study the community and find out what the needs really are. And someone stood up and in the middle of it and said, well, maybe we should look at the community and find out what we already have for programs and what strengths we have and what resources we have, and then make a determination where our congregation best fits into that programmatically. So just an example of how this is being played out and lived day to day. Slide 22, I've just put some questions in there. We can either go to these if nobody has any other comments or questions during the time that Rick's going to unmute us here. But otherwise, these are just there for you to kind of prompt your own thinking. And if you have a study group of students or staff that you want to look at some of this stuff with, you can certainly use those for that purpose as well. So we've made it through some of the, I think, more difficult or at least less dynamic kind of content in that first topic. And you've heard my stoic Dutch voice for a while. So, Rick, let's bring folks on and see if they have any questions.
Okay, Marty, I think we're all open.
Very good. Anybody want to start us off? Questions, comments, thoughts?
Rick, this is Gordon Murphy.
Yes, Gordon.
And I would just comment, one of the last topics that Marty was addressing was this assets versus needs. And we've learned one of the more interesting groups that's really addressing that is the Asset-Based Community Development Institute based around Northwestern University. I'm not sure if Marty made reference to that or not. I missed a couple of his comments, but it's a great awareness for us about how to look at a community from an assets environment.
Right, that's Jody Kretzman and John McKnight's outfit.
John McKnight, mm-hmm, right.
Yes, they have a book called, thanks for mentioning it, Gordon, called Building Communities from the Inside Out. It's actually a green paperback, rather bulky thing, but it does a great job of providing the tools and the resources. And there's a set of videos you can get as well.
Yeah.
Good point, thank you.
For those of you who don't know, Gordon Murphy is the, or is it president or executive director, Gordon?
Just executive director.
Executive director of the Christian Community Development Association, so particularly delighted to have your input. Thanks, Gordon.
Anybody else want to throw out any comments, thoughts, questions, curiosities, personal experiences? One of the challenges with this system is I can't prod you if you're asleep, so hopefully everyone is there with us yet. Do you want to move on? All right. Let's do that.
Just before we move on, can I ask one quick question about do you think community organizing can enhance community development, or do you think it gets in the way?
You know,
I guess I'd say specifically faith-based community organizing.
Yeah. There's when we get a little further down into the material, you'll see a couple of books I'm referencing. Dry Bones Rattling is one that's just been written, and another, Faith in Action, which really focus purely on faith-based community organizing. And there are results. And if you look at Brooklyn, for example, there's a program called Nehemiah Plan Homes that emerged out of an Industrial Area Foundation's work there. And they have created a large number of units. And there's another program that started off with a neighborhood housing services group that used a different model, which was far more community development oriented and a lot less community organizing. Now, we just went through a process in a class I'm in here evaluating the pros and cons of each, which one was better. And it's very difficult to say that one was better than the other because they both achieved, at this point, a certain level of accomplishment. But when we get to these levels of success, measuring success, we don't know yet. There's still some things that haven't been identified or measured in terms of their overall outcome. I think there is the danger in community organizing to alienate people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that we find as a challenge, because if you're about sustainable relationships, it's an interesting perspective. Habitat for Humanity affiliates can be kind of in your face in that we'll find a piece of infill property in a neighborhood where nobody wants to have that kind of house built. And it in and of itself can become a community organizing thing if we have to confront the NIMBY issues, not in my backyard issues of that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have, to take that a step further, I then move a family into that house and the neighborhood doesn't like the house, they inevitably, you know, protract those feelings onto the family as well. So what have I done? I've basically alienated people, and I haven't built relationships.
Is there some citation about what you're just talking about, of who's written about? Is there some citation between what you're talking about what's written, about the contrast between?
Yeah, when we get a little further down, there's some stuff about community engagement that you're going to see.
Okay.
And there's a piece that Alex here at the Joint Center has done, Alexander von Hoffman, that I think really lays out those two issues very well.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right, Rick, let's move into the next level of the discussion. Thank you. Topic two is what is then this faith-based community development, and how would I know it when I see it? If we've got these general concepts down of community. And so slide 24, I've just decided instead of jumping right into it that I want us to hesitate and reflect again. And so you're saying, well, that's real nice. But I'd like to return to this concept of justice and a community because I think it still lays out a strong frame for why the faith community would engage in community development. And three norms that I've come to really like are from a book that Ron Sider has done called Just Generosity. Many of you may know Ron and his significant work with Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger and other books like that. The Just Generosity book is not all that old and does have a study guide with it, by the way, in case you ever want to do that with your staff or your church or your school. But he gives us these three norms, and I'll just quickly read through them for those of you who don't have the material in front of you. Normally, all people who can work should have access to the productive resources so that if they act responsibly, they can produce or purchase an abundant sufficiency of all that is needed to enjoy a dignified, healthy life in community. Two, the difference in wealth between rich and poor dare not become so great that the great inequalities of wealth and therefore power lead to oppression. And three, those who cannot care for themselves should receive from their community a liberal sufficiency of the necessities of life, provided in ways that preserve dignity, encourage responsibility, and strengthen the family. All right, that said, let's take a look at this report from the Department of Housing and Urban Development called Faith-Based Organizations and Community Development Institute. Took responsibility for pulling this together and towards the end of 2001, not all that long ago. But I venture to say, excuse me, that there's a whole lot that has happened since then that still needs to be researched. And it's one of the outcomes of this summary that I've put in here of the report, is that more research and more work needs to be done. But let's take a look at some of the material here. On page 25, if you have it in front of you on your screen, faith-based organizations are of three types. One, congregations. Two, national networks, which include denominations, social service arms. And three, freestanding religious organizations were incorporated separately from congregations and national networks. Now, the next point is interesting. More than half of all congregations and many other faith-based organizations provide some form of human services. Congregational participation in providing human services is greater among worship communities that are larger, that probably doesn't surprise us, are located in low-income neighborhoods, theologically liberal, and are African-American. Supportive pastoral leadership is central. These are the findings of this report. Now, if we go to slide 26, we go to going back to that definition we gave you earlier of community development from HUD. It's pure definition. A key finding of this report is that relatively few faith-based organizations participate in community development activities. Okay, so they say, you know, we've got a lot of folks getting involved in human service, but true community development, there seems to be few. Most common are faith-based community development, or CDCs, corporations, and some national denominations and their affiliates, and Habitat for Humanity. Now, let's look at some of the reasons they cite why faith-based participation is limited, and maybe you can reflect on these based on your experiences, or you can contradict them if you don't believe they're true. But here's what we say. Congregations have two preferred approaches. They donate small amounts of cash or goods, or they provide volunteers. By contrast, community development activities require regular and sustained involvement in a range of complex processes and tasks. The next one, community development is best done by independently incorporated organizations, and establishing and fostering the growth of such organizations are the least common mode of congregational engagement. Congregational staff and volunteers typically lack skills, knowledge, and time required to successfully sponsor community development projects. Most congregations have not applied for government grants. In my experience and work with the Siouxland Diaconal Conference, the Christian Reformed World Relief Committee, and Habitat and others, getting involved in taking money that has the level of management accountability that the government funding has requires a whole new level of capacity. And a lot of folks who give us money these days, donors, want us to be using it for sticks and bricks or actual program, and don't like to see money lost in management. So it's a huge issue. And then we have this other point, which I think is a really important one. No existing research compares how the outcomes of community development sponsored by faith-based organizations compares with the of secular organizations. Some information is available about the challenges facing those that have tried, but little is known about the impediments faced by the minority of faith-based organizations interested in especially obtaining government funds. So these are some questions that new research ought to focus on. And then you have some implications there. Community development field needs significant technical assistance to ensure that faith-based organizations spend government funds responsibly if they're getting involved in taking government money. Faith-based organizations that want to get involved in community development may increase their effectiveness by partnering or collaborating with existing entities that are already doing this work. And then the last point they're making there, only a fraction of the organizations studied currently have resources to successfully engage in community development. However, when they do, faith-based organizations are uniquely positioned to have a significant impact beyond simply sponsoring projects. Congregations can increase public support for affordable housing and other development initiatives in their communities by engaging in dialogue and joining coalitions that support social justice. Interesting and powerful, I think, as it gives us some direction in terms of where we can be putting our energy as social workers. But it all goes on to say, you know, there's a whole lot more to know and learn. And that's a challenge that I want to leave you thinking about for those of you who are in the position to initiate research projects or to encourage people to do that, that obviously there's more work that needs to be done in that area. Now, let's leap on over to slide number 30. And this is where you're going to see a deviation from a lot of the material I've just extracted or packaged. This is just a compilation of 7 proposed qualities that I'm putting out there from what I've learned and what I've read. So let's go through these and see if they resonate with you. And as you're going through this, I would hope that you think of ones that you think should be added to this list as well, because it's not intended to be comprehensive, but a place to start from. Number one, obviously, you know, is connected to and performed by the faith community and takes risks from a position of faith. I believe that there is a challenge there. If you look at what the HUD report is saying and what many of us have experienced, is that getting involved at something this deep, at this deep a level, which is different than just collecting cans of soup and vegetables and bringing them to a food pantry, requires some risk-taking. And I believe that the faith community has the opportunity to do what it does best, listen, pray, believe, and do. And so that being the first. Second is grounded in social justice with a desire to improve the quality of life in the community. A little bit harder to mobilize sometimes our congregations around the issue of social justice can be a bit of a unease and anxiety raiser for some, but definitely believe that in the end it's essential that social justice be the motivation from which we move. Many years ago, I had the opportunity to go meet with Bishop Robert Carlson of the Catholic Diocese and was trying to engage him in working with our organization, Habitat for Humanity. And we had a really deep and meaningful conversation about housing issues and the role of the church and all of that. And he looks at me and he says, you know, Marty, one thing that would really I'm curious about is, when are you going to stop marketing your program around being fun and romantic and exciting and help people understand that it is their responsibility from a social justice perspective to be doing this? And it really struck me that, you know, his perception of how the organization of Habitat for Humanity is marketed is not motivated necessarily by these issues. Well, some of that may be hidden behind the back burner a little too far, but at any rate, definitely caused me to think about, you know, the work that we need to be doing to help people understand what our mandate and our calling is. Three, has a holistic focus and is development rather than charity oriented. The two main key issues there. One, the holistic focus is really about whether or not, you know, the approach we're taking seeks to address all of the issues that a person is facing, not one that's only spiritually oriented or one that's only physically oriented, the one that takes into consideration all of the needs of the individual and the community. And then the challenge, I think, that we face in the faith-based community, in my experience, is that many of us, myself included, tend to be toolbox kind of people, fix-it folk. And we see a problem, we see a challenge, and we want to go in there and fix it, and we enable in our helping rather than truly offering folks an opportunity to help themselves. And some of you may have figured out how to do this better than others, but it is a real challenge, I think, in the faith community that we carry with us. And kind of a paternalistic charity orientation goes contrary to that type of work. The next one being holds participation of and by the local community paramount. And, you know, I think that pretty well speaks for itself, but you're going to see some things coming up in some of these slides about community engagement, whether or not it's realistic. And this one, I think, is critical. Respects and builds on the gifts and strengths of the community. Models a spirit of community by collaborating with others and avoids duplication and promotes stewardship. What I'm really getting at there is that there are existing programs in place that we partner with and figure out ways of working together as opposed to creating new programs and new models just because we want to have our name, so to speak, on them. Where I did my social work field placement, I was doing crisis intervention and emergency assistance, and the community there, not all that large a community, had 7 food pantries that were going on. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out that this was happening, and I started to ask the question, what in the world is going on here? Why would we need 7 food pantries? Well, the duplication comes from the fact that, you know, many of these entities, these churches and other groups, wanted to have their own identity, and they also wanted to use the food pantry as a consumer front in that if you get people to walk in the door to donate food to you, they'll probably write you a check and other things as well. So they were using it as a marketing means to get donors in the door. And again, you know, what does that say about our stewardship and our focus from the faith-based perspective? And then lastly, it's built on patience and perseverance and a long-term commitment. Today's, I'll just speak for, you know, us Americans, we're all about instant gratification and immediate results. And those of you who work with people know that that doesn't necessarily happen and certainly doesn't happen in community development either. I know many groups who've tried to do work in environments overseas and they lay out a strategic plan that says in 3 years we'll be out of here, the whole thing will be run and locally owned and operated, and 10 years later they're still working on the first phase of their plan, and folks are disappointed. But I think there is a reality that, you know, commitment needs to be long-suffering in this particular arena. Let's jump to some models and resources, and thankfully we have Gordon here with us, so I'm actually going to tap him in just a second or two to talk a little bit about CCDA. But the first model and resource I put up on slide 31 is John Perkins, and I've got to know John through work I'd done for years back in Northwest Iowa with an organization called Justice for All. And John really promotes for us, you know, 3, I think, very clear concepts, the 3 R's of Christian community development, and those being relocation, reconciliation, and redistribution of resources. And beautiful in their form because they really go to the heart of some of the stuff we've already talked about, being a part of the community as opposed to from the outside, and being willing to work on relationship issues, bringing people of diverse backgrounds, values together, and then really the social justice side of making sure that wealth and access to goods and resources is there through redistribution. I will say some of the first times I've written about this concepts and explored them a bit, back in my home territory, evoked letters of calling me a communist and a socialist and all of these sorts of things. But, you know, it's good stuff. John has written a number of books, and, you know, really I think the CCDA movement has kind of evolved from John's beginning work. And so, Rick, if you could you unmute it maybe, and Gordon, could you just tell us a little bit about CCDA and what you guys do? Are you there, Gordon? Has he left us? One last check. Gordon, are you there? Okay. Go ahead and mute it again, Rick, and we'll move on. There is a web address there for CCDA, and you can go there. Primarily, They do technical assistance and networking for community development work, and they have an annual conference each year as well. You can find out the timing of that. I believe it's in October of this year in Atlanta on their website. But they also have some resources and materials there, and as I say at the end of the presentation, it's a great place for you to go and get started in your education process. Habitat for Humanity's website is there. I don't need to say a whole lot about that organization other than the mission statement of Habitat is really to develop communities by building and renovating houses. How well the organization has achieved that varies significantly from community to community. Because the focus has been primarily on the housing side, there hasn't been any work done to research and measure whether or not there's overall community impact. Some of our locations are measuring things like change in tax base, other community conditions that might be improving, but just starting to do that. So there's a lot of work to be done there in terms of whether or not Habitat's having an overall impact. If you're looking for a safe and non-threatening entree into getting into some of this community work, there is always a place for you, though, no matter what your skills or interests, in Habitat for Humanity. So I would offer that to you as a good place to start in getting yourself engaged in some of these issues, have you not been. And the last one there, Nehemiah Plan Homes, I talked briefly about. A little project started up in Brooklyn with a group of congregations, actually one congregation in particular, and evolved into this idea of Nehemiah Plan Homes, which ended up building in 20,000 units of housing now in various locations, and has become a model that's been used in a number of places. But started with and from the IAF model of community organizing. So there's still some questions about, you know, the relevance of what they're doing in terms of how they go about it. But those four locations, and there's an article location that I've given you there on the URL that gets you in there to start with. So four possibilities. There's a whole lot more, and I'll be telling you at the end of the session how I'm working on a paper that includes all these resources. Now I'd like to take up the issue of success a bit and wrestle with that, and then we'll try to wrap up this topic and get to some questions. First, a quote there. Again, if you have come to help me, you are wasting your time, but if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. I think sets the tone, really, for how we measure and define success and whether or not we realize that if a community is to be healthy and whole, it means that everyone in the community is contributing and everyone in the community is experiencing the joys of their contribution and the results. Determining what to assess can be a challenge. Looking at change over time requires the patience and the tenacity and the resources to do longitudinal studies. A lot of the studies that we do tend not to be longitudinal simply because, you know, of the commitment there. And in this case, as you know, our bottom line is both social and economic. So measuring financial change in the business sector with that kind of bottom line can be fairly straightforward compared to what we're trying to do in terms of measuring social change. Screen 33 gives you some additional ideas on things to look at in terms of indicators of success. Let's just run through these, and then I will ask you when we break next time for your thoughts and ideas on additional indicators of success. So be thinking about the ones that are missing. First, physical changes in buildings, parks, lots, streets, and infrastructure. Kind of that windshield survey type of stuff. If I can walk down the street or drive in my car and I start to see change, I can count fewer broken windows. I can count painted buildings, count parks, and so forth. The next being the increase in property taxes that are being generated by the property there. That's a fairly easy one to measure in a geographic boundary community. Reduction in nuisance abatement and crime events. These things are measurable. Reduced homelessness, health problems, things of that nature. Whether or not the local leadership is involved in owning decisions and making the decisions, or if those are still being made by people outside of the community. And increased linkages and social networks are being reported by people who live there. There are qualitative ways to assess that as well. But I think in the faith-based community development side, there's a whole other dimension to assessing success that we need to take a look at, and that is whether or not for the faith-based entities themselves, are the members of a congregation, for example, more engaged, giving more time, talent, and tithe than we did before? Are people, getting a sense of their being able to bring reality to the rhetoric and doing something about their commitment and their talk on a given week? So there's, I think, an opportunity there for us to develop a whole new set of measures and look at ways in which faith-based entities themselves, churches, congregations, synagogues, and others are finding change within their own community because of the work they're doing in community development efforts. So please be thinking about other indicators, and we'll bring that up at our next break. Now let's take a look at this question of local engagement. How true to form is it in practice? And this is the document I was referencing earlier, this industry note called Issues in Nonprofit Community Development. It's put out by the Kennedy School and done by Alex Van Hoffman here at the Joint Center for Housing Studies. And he goes on to say, ask the question, are community-based organizations truly community-based? Articles in the news media and community development public relations materials frequently suggest that community development groups are grassroots indigenous organizations that express the aspirations of low-income residents of the inner city. Although small groups of local activists start or are sponsored by many community development organizations, as a rule, they're neither democratic or indigenous. The people who manage community-based organizations and their projects differ from the most of their constituents in education, occupational level, and not even frequently neighborhood of residence. Which takes us right back to the John Perkins first R of the three R's being relocation, or being a part of the community in which you're engaging. And so that same document also has in it some additional thoughts about, the value of community organizing versus community development and so forth. But just an interesting remark, I think, to take us back to the success question and how difficult it can be to truly be doing community development. And then a bit more about this community organizing issue and one of the two books I mentioned earlier, Faith in Action. Richard Wood says, community organizing typically describes work inspired by the Dean of Community Organizers, Saul Alinsky. Although faith-based organizing remains rather unknown in academic circles, the first nationwide study of the field shows it to be second in size only to the labor movement among drives for social justice among low-income Americans. 133 local or metropolitan area federations linking some 3,500 congregations, 500 schools, local labor unions, and other institutions, faith-based organizing can plausibly claim to touch the lives of some 2 million members of these institutions in all major urban areas and many secondary cities around the U.S. So community organizing from the faith-based realm has, according to Richard Wood, engaged a lot of people, and I think is something to pay attention to as well. Then just a quote here to wrap up topic two.
coming from the book Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. Although Americans are by and large affluent beyond the dreams of the rest of the world, many of us have lost something invaluable, belonging to a community. The presence of community is a powerful reminder that authentic wealth does not consist in the size of one's bank account, but in the depth and diversity of relationships within the community. The mechanic that won't overcharge you, the neighbor you can trust your kids with, the landscape and other creatures so familiar that you know you are home.
All to today's audio conference workshop, which is entitled Faith-Based Community Development, An Exciting Call to Servanthood for Christians and Social Work. It's going to be presented by Marty Koistra, who's the Content and Knowledge Manager at For Humanity University. Today's audio conference will provide a brief overview of faith-based community development, including exploring key concepts of community development and what makes communities healthy and whole. In addition, this audio conference will look at effective models of faith-based community development and evaluate a variety of indicators of success. Finally, we'll challenge participants to find ways to build community in their own respective locales. As we mentioned, today's session will be delivered by NACSW member Marty Koistra, who's been with Habitat for Humanity for a number of years in various positions. They've included Senior Affiliate Support Manager, Regional Director, and then also Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity at Greater Sioux Falls. Just before we begin our session, let me quickly cover a few important housekeeping items. First of all, after this general introduction, and for most of the conference today, we'll be using a muting function to eliminate background noise. I'm sure you can already hear the dogs barking and the trucks passing by for those of you on cell phones, and we find that by muting you out for most of the time, you'll actually be able to hear Marty without having to strain. But at different intervals, he'll ask for the muting function to be taken off, and we'll enter a live mode where there'll be the possibility of questions and answers. Our request is that anything at that point in your background can be heard by the whole group, so do whatever you can to keep the background noise to an absolute minimum. Secondly, during the question and answer periods, do try to keep your questions and comments crisp. We have a fairly large audience, and again, just the courtesy of making sure we give everyone the opportunity to speak who wants a chance. And then lastly, we invite you to follow the outline which he's provided and that we posted on our website, and you can get there by following the link that we provided previously. If for some reason you have difficulty accessing the outline, let me know via email, and I'll send you a copy either as we're speaking or immediately after today's session. And so without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, Marty Koistra. If you can give me just a minute, Marty, to go into mute mode, we'll be set to go.
Very good. Thank you, Rick. I hope everyone can hear me. It's great to be here with you and to have this opportunity. It's also exciting to see the folks at NACSW taking seriously this role of the social work profession in engaging in community work. My social work background goes back to days at Dort College in Sioux Center, Iowa, where I got a BSW. And I recall the challenge in engaging in more macro practice work because there weren't a lot of opportunities, first of all, for field placement and internships, but secondly, the priority seemed to be focused more on micro practice issues. This, however, is near and dear unto my heart. Just a little bit more about myself before we get into the content, and we will be relying heavily on the presentation, so hopefully, as Rick said, if you aren't able to get it from the URL he provided in HTML format, let him know and he will email it to you via a PowerPoint presentation that you could download and print in that way as well. I grew up in a small town in northwest Iowa and spent most of my energetic life doing construction work for 7 years. I ran my own construction business. And then went on to college and got a degree in social work and sociology. And from there, ended up moving into the realm of Habitat. And as Rick mentioned, a number of roles, 14 years now. And it's been a good learning experience for me to address my passions and beliefs in how we as Christians walk here on earth and what we should be doing. The issue of community is near and dear unto my heart. And as you can see as we go through this, it's something that will be a focus of what you'll be hearing from me both here and if you come to the conference in D.C. There's a whole track actually being done on community development there, where there will be another presentation, and hopefully in the future more and more on this topic. So with that in mind, let's move into the actual material, and the agenda will be we'll go through three topics and stop after each one for some Q&A or other remarks that people have. Certainly, I know there are folks on this call who bear a tremendous amount of expertise and experience in this field, and if we can, in the time we're allotted, we'll try to tap into that. And I'm certainly going to encourage everyone to continue the dialogue afterwards. We can connect via email or a number of other technological ways to keep things moving forward from here. Let's take a look, if you have in front of you your material, briefly on slide number 5. I just want to make a couple of comments. Where I am right now is physically at Harvard. I am in the Joint Center for Housing Studies, and I'm on a 3-month sabbatical from Habitat with a Bush Fellowship, studying primarily community capacity and competence as it relates to affordable housing. But since being here, I got here about the second week of September. I've been inundated with a whole new realm of content and material and thought and being intellectually stimulated. And so I consider what you're about to experience very much a work in progress, because what I'm finding is there's a whole lot more to be mined and unearthed in the field, and still some things that we don't know. There is not a lot of information out there on what we'll call pure faith-based community development, if we use a housing and urban development definition of that, and we'll talk more about that, especially in terms of measuring impact. And I am hoping that we can open up a whole new realm of understanding and research in this area in the future. So that said, let's get into some definitions and concepts, and if you have your slides in front of you, slide 6 is just a little funny thing I stuck in there to basically say, I know you want to get to the meat of things, but bear with me, we're going to build a framework first, and the scaffolding will be kind of these definitions and concepts that we're going to go through. First one, what is community? And let's look at just briefly some biblical perspectives. And I would hope while we're doing this that your mind is prompted to think of any kind of references or experiences you have that really come to mind that reflect on community. I know the Old Testament, if you review especially the book of Leviticus, there's a lot of material and the work and the prophets that kind of point us to what community is about, and justice issues and caring for the needs of others. And so I've stuck in your presentation just two small examples, the first being from the book of Psalms 107 and the second being from Acts chapter 2, which is a New Testament kind of rendition of the power of the Spirit working in the lives of people to build community from a relationship perspective. Now we'll move to slide number 9, what is community? And there is a lot of definitions out there, as you know, on what is community. I've just tried to pick two ways of looking at it here that are very similar. And the first coming from Philip Fellin's book, The Community and the Social Worker, which happened to be my favorite text when I was going through my BSW work. And it says, a community exists when a group of people form a social unit based on common location, interest, identification, and some common combination of these characteristics. So then that leads us to say there's three major types of communities. Those with geographic boundaries that are distinguished by locality or place. Those created and maintained through identification and interest, such as communities based on ethnicity, culture, race, religion, lifestyle, sexual orientation, social class, occupation, etc., etc. And then thirdly, those distinguished by an overlap of geographical location with identification or interest. If you move to the next slide, 10, another way to put it, taking this from Suzanne Morris's book, which was just released, she works for the Pew Leadership folks, called Smart Communities. Community is a term that is used very specifically on the one hand and casually on the other, very true, but it involves around three nexuses: the community of relationships, the community of interests, and the community of place. And so, you know, I'd like us to try to use that simplicity as we move forward in this thing, there being relationships, interest, and place. Some attributes of good community, just a quote here from Wilma Mankiller: I think a healthy community is one where people are not just out for themselves, and they are not just working on their individual pursuits, but where they understand their relationship and responsibility to other people. What are some desirable attributes of community? And I just pulled out here a couple of quotes for you from David Gushee's book, Toward a Just and Caring Society, and find these to be helpful. And this takes us back to the conversation about social justice in the Old Testament. The first being, persons are created for community. Scriptures understand the good life as sharing in the essential aspects of social life. Therefore, justice includes restoration to community. Justice includes helping people return to the kind of life and community which God intends for them. The concern is for the whole person and what it takes to maintain persons in that relationship. And then community membership means the ability to share fully within one's capacity and potential in each essential aspect. And we're talking here about everything: decision making, social life, et cetera, as well as having one's physical and material needs met. And a key role there, looking at the decent life. So, having gone through that, let's take the next leap here into what is community development. And I'm going to have us wrestle through not only what is community development, but the term community building and a bit about community organizing, and see if we can come up with some sense, at least, of where I'm wrestling through these definitions and where I think it can be helpful. The Wilder Foundation tells us that the community development definitions tend to share, you know, the common elements of process, bringing people together, so to speak, to change the quality of life. And other definitions involve the process of building networks and improving the capacity of individuals and organizations. And then there are others that focus on improvements within the community without necessarily working on the relationship building aspect. The definition you have at the bottom of page 13 comes from a HUD report, Faith-Based Organizations and Community Development, which I believe Rick sent you the link for. The link is also included in this presentation that you can download. And it is, community development is asset building, centers around housing and community economic development, but also includes developmental efforts such as job training to prepare residents for more productive lives. Interestingly enough, if you take a holistic approach and view of community development, it's ironic that many organizations end up starting off with or focusing on housing as their core issue, because there is a number of other things, as you know, that need to be taking place, not just housing. In Habitat for Humanity, we've learned this both the hard way and the long way in terms of just creating a place for someone, a house, in a dysfunctional neighborhood or in a neighborhood in a community that doesn't thrive or meet someone, the rest of someone's needs, does not necessarily provide a solution. But economic development seems to be much more difficult and harder to get into, and I think that's one of the reasons why we see organizations and entities gravitating towards the kind of intrinsic value they can get from doing housing. Let's move on to community building then, and there's some definitions you see there on page 14. Community building generally refers to building the social networks within the community, and developing group and individual problem-solving and leadership skills. Wilder says their definition is any identifiable set of activities pursued by a community in order to increase community social capacity. And then there's just a couple other definitions I've provided there. Practice of building connections and concern strengthening the capacity of neighborhood residents, et cetera, to collectively, individually and collectively, to foster and sustain positive neighborhood change. And then we'll take the next step is what is community organizing? Referring to the process of bringing community members together and providing them with tools to help themselves. Community organizing is a strategy for building communities and for community development. Perhaps best known is the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is the work of Saul Alinsky for a number of years in the community organizing field. Now, let me just qualify something at this stage. It's interesting when you read about how some people view community organizing in its relationship to community development. There are some views and perspectives that believe that community organizing as a strategy does not necessarily foster true community development because it's kind of in your face, up front kind of behavior that may not work on the relationship side or may not be sustainable. It certainly, as we have seen in a number of cases, has an upfront impact, an immediate impact of change, but whether or not folks appreciate the style and the nature and the way it goes about doing things and whether that's sustainable is questionable. And I'll leave that to your experience and research to kind of flesh out, but it is an interesting dynamic. Slide 16, what I've done here is tried to just obfuscate things for you by saying if you want to have some fun, go on the internet and type in community development, and you'll get inundated with definitions of what people say community development is. There's a lot of them, and there's just a small sampling there on that page. Let's pick it up on 17 then. So confusing is all of this talk about community. For me, to sort through all of that, this is kind of how I have come to terms with it, and we'll see if this helps you at all. Community development might be seen as overall activities and interventions that enhance the relationships of members, which respect and leverage the interests represented there within that community, that transform the place through housing, economic, and workforce development, and have the goal of improving the quality of life. Community organizing and community development may be viewed as aspects of or methods to do community development. See if that helps you a bit. And there's just a few more definitions and concepts I'd like to take up at this point. And then we'll stop and let folks ask any questions or provide comments and feedback at that point. I'm going to slide 19 now, if you have it in front of you. What is community capacity? And 20 is community competence. And these are things that I find to be extremely important, especially in the work that Habitat for Humanity is doing. Just to bring it home a bit, we have a model where we try to replicate this affiliate community model around the country and around the world. We're now in 1,700 locations in the United States, 90 countries overall, building roughly 17,000 houses a year using volunteers and community folk. But the notion that we can take and look at performance and the ability to generate productivity purely based on organizational capacity has become a real challenge. And what I've been saying all along is we need to take a look at what are the indicators of capacity that the community has and the competence that the community has and mesh that with our organizational capacity issues to find out what really the carrying focus, the ability of the community to solve its affordable housing issues are. And it's going to require a much different approach than purely just building units. It's
all about collaboration, engaging in the community, advocacy, education, and so forth, as many of you well know. But capacity and competence of the community, I think, are key central points in this area. And I've chosen two definitions or explanations of these concepts coming from the Foundations of Social Work Practice book that I've inserted here. On the capacity side, refers to the characteristics of communities that affect their ability to identify, mobilize, and act to resolve community issues and concerns. Key dimensions include participation in leadership, access to and wise use of resources. And incidentally, it's my view that every community has resources. For a number of years, I was doing work in South Dakota on the Native American reservations there. And there are many stories of situations where we continue to unearth and find and mine resource potential and resource possibilities. And a lot of folks have the impression that certain communities just don't have resources. And I prefer to look at it from a different perspective and say, I know there's resources there. The question is are we able to help support the community in utilizing those and leveraging those resources? Social and interorganizational networks, a sense of community. Again, now there's an interesting way to see the word used after our definitions. It's kind of been parked in the middle of this thing, a sense of community. Community history of collective action, community power, shared core values, and capacity to engage in critical reflection. Maybe just briefly a little bit about where I grew up. I grew up in a town of 700 people, and I remember as a child the decision was made that our community would have an outdoor heated swimming pool. Now, this probably tells you how old I am, but it was very interesting and exciting for us as kids to think, wow, we're going to have a swimming pool in our community. And it's going to be heated nonetheless. And it took 3.5 years, mind you, for this little town for us to generate the money to buy the materials, to utilize volunteers to build this swimming pool. So there was this huge thermometer plopped up on the street corner hanging on one of the street lights that someone would go with red paint and paint new marks every time we'd done a fundraiser or somebody had made a gift and finally had enough money to say we can go ahead and do this. And it's indicative of a community that has the capacity to bring people together. That same community for now 50 years has done a celebration on the 4th of July. 700 people in the community, 10,000 folks show up on the 4th of July every year to experience the vibrant celebration that they have, and it's known throughout the area as being the place to go. So there's a capacity there. Now, there are downsides to that community, and I'm not going to elaborate on what those are, but you can see that when people come together with shared values and some collective action and leadership, they can accomplish significant things. On the competence side, we're looking more at things that involve activities that strengthen investment and commitment, clarification of issues and interest, development of the ability of community members to articulate views, attitudes, needs, and intentions, enhancement of communication skills, and this one is so immensely critical in today's society where we have a number of different groups and factions and issues represented, and the ability for us to communicate openly and safely and respectfully along those lines are essential for problem-solving things to take place. The ability to negotiate differences and manage conflict, and then participation from the membership. And then finally, the question of assets and deficits, and I'm sure that all of you have confronted or heard about, you know, the different paradigms that we have in terms of should we focus on the needs of the community or should we focus first on the strengths and the assets of the community. And I chose to put a clipboard on there as a little icon, if you can see that or if you have it printed out. because of the tendency for us to have our checklists mentally or physically of saying, you know, these are the things that you should have, and let me run around and see if you've got them or not. And if I identify that you don't, that means it's a need or a deficit, and I'm going to develop a way to correct that. And, you know, I think that many of us are finding, whether we're doing family strengthening kinds of work or community work, that starting off with assets and really looking at those can help change the frame of reference and help us determine what we can work with to leverage what the community has in its terms of its capacity and its competence to change for the better. Just yesterday, I'm visiting a church here called Old Cambridge Baptist Church, and they have a huge old building that's kind of a deep black hole in for them financially. So they've taken all the pews out of this church and turned the whole thing into a huge dance studio. And on Sunday mornings, they throw down some chairs and a pulpit and have church in there. But it's a revenue-generating stream for them in order to keep the facility going and the church alive. They had been involved in doing an overnight shelter when the weather got below 10 degrees below zero. They offered some rooms in their basement as a shelter for folks off the street here in Cambridge. Well, that program didn't necessarily work out real well, but yesterday during their congregational meeting, I was observing they were wrestling with the issue of what should their ministry to those who are homeless be. And ironically, the conversation came up, well, we need to study the community and find out what the needs really are. And someone stood up and in the middle of it and said, well, maybe we should look at the community and find out what we already have for programs and what strengths we have and what resources we have, and then make a determination where our congregation best fits into that programmatically. So an example of how this is being played out and lived day to day. Slide 22, I've just put some questions in there. We can either go to these if nobody has any other comments or questions during the time that Rick's going to unmute us here. But otherwise, these are just there for you to kind of prompt your own thinking. And if you have a study group of students or staff that you want to look at some of this stuff with, you can certainly use those for that purpose as well. So we've made it through some of the, I think, more difficult or at least less dynamic kind of content in that first topic. And you've heard my stoic Dutch voice for a while. So, Rick, let's bring folks on and see if they have any questions.
Okay, Marty, I think we're all open.
Very good. Anybody want to start us off? Questions, comments, thoughts?
Rick, this is Gordon Murphy.
Yes, Gordon.
And I would just comment, one of the last topics that Marty was addressing was this assets versus needs. And we've learned one of the more interesting groups that's really addressing that is the Asset-Based Community Development Institute based around Northwestern University. I'm not sure if Marty made reference to that or not. I missed a couple of his comments. But it's a great awareness for us about how to look at a community from an assets environment.
Right, that's Jody Kretzman and John McKnight's outfit.
John McKnight, mm-hmm, right.
Yes, they have a book called, thanks for mentioning it, Gordon, called Building Communities from the Inside Out. It's actually a green paperback, rather bulky thing, but it does a great job of providing the tools and the resources. And there's a set of videos you can get as well.
Yeah.
Good point, thank you.
For those of you who don't know, Gordon Murphy is the, or is it president or executive director, Gordon?
Executive Director.
Executive Director of the Christian Community Development Association, so particularly delighted to have your input. Thanks, Gordon.
Anybody else want to throw out any comments, thoughts, questions, curiosities, personal experiences? One of the challenges with this system is I can't prod you if you're asleep, so hopefully everyone is there with us yet. Do you want to move on? All right. Let's do that.
Just before we move on, can I ask one quick question about, do you think community organizing can enhance community development, or do you think it gets in the way?
You know, you
I guess I'd say specifically faith-based community organizing.
Yeah. There's when we get a little further down into the material, you'll see a couple of books I'm referencing.
Okay.
Dry Bones Rattling is one that's just been written, and another, Faith in Action, which really focus purely on faith-based community organizing. And there are results. And if you look at Brooklyn, for example, there's a program called Nehemiah Plan Homes that emerged out of an Industrial Area Foundation's work there. And they have created a large number of units. And there's another program that started off with a Niagara Housing Services group that used a different model, which was far more community development oriented and a lot less community organizing. Now, we just went through a process in a class I'm in here evaluating the pros and cons of each, which one was better. And it's very difficult to say that one was better than the other because they both achieved, at this point, a certain level of accomplishment. But when we get to these levels of success, measuring success, we don't know yet. There's still some things that haven't been identified or measured in terms of their overall outcome. I think there is the danger in community organizing to alienate people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that we find as a challenge, because if you're about sustainable relationships, it's an interesting perspective. Habitat for Humanity affiliates can be kind of in your face in that we'll find a piece of infill property in a neighborhood where nobody wants to have that kind of house built. And it in and of itself can become a community organizing thing if we have to confront the NIMBY issues, not in my backyard issues of that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have, to take that a step further, I then move a family into that house and the neighborhood doesn't like the house, they inevitably, you know, protract those feelings onto the family as well. So what have I done? I've basically alienated people, and I haven't built relationships.
Is there some citation about what you're just talking about? Of who's written about? Is there some citation between what you're talking about where it's written, about
yeah.
the contrast between?
Yeah, when we get a little further down, there's some stuff about community engagement that you're going to see.
Okay.
And there's a piece that Alex here at the Joint Center has done, Alexander Van Hoffman, that I think really lays out those two issues very well.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right, Rick, let's move into the next level of the discussion. Thank you. Topic two is what is then this faith-based community development, and how would I know it when I see it? If we've got these general concepts down of community. And so slide 24, I've just decided instead of jumping right into it that I want us to hesitate and reflect again. And so you're saying, well, that's real nice. But I'd like to return to this concept of justice and a community because I think it still lays out a strong frame for why the faith community would engage in community development. And three norms that I've come to really like are from a book that Ron Sider has done called Just Generosity. Many of you may know Ron and his significant work with Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger and other books like that. The Just Generosity book is not all that old and does have a study guide with it, by the way, in case you ever want to do that with your staff or your church or your school. But he gives us these three norms, and I'll just quickly read through them for those of you who don't have the material in front of you. Normally, all people who can work should have access to the productive resources so that if they act responsibly, they can produce or purchase an abundant sufficiency of all that is needed to enjoy a dignified, healthy life in community. Two, the difference in wealth between rich and poor dare not become so great that the great inequalities of wealth and therefore power lead to oppression. And three, those who cannot care for themselves should receive from their community a liberal sufficiency of the necessities of life, provided in ways that preserve dignity, encourage responsibility, and strengthen the family. All right, that said, let's take a look at this report from the Department of Housing and Urban Development called Faith-Based Organizations and Community Development. Institute took responsibility for pulling this together and towards the end of 2001, not all that long ago. But I venture to say, excuse me, that there's a whole lot that has happened since then that still needs to be researched. And it's one of the outcomes of this summary that I've put in here of the report is that more research and more work needs to be done. But let's take a look at some of the material here. On page 25, if you have it in front of you on your screen, faith-based organizations are of three types. One, congregations. Two, national networks, which include denominations, social service arms. And three, freestanding religious organizations were incorporated separately from congregations and national networks. Now, the next point is interesting. More than half of all congregations and many other faith-based organizations provide some form of human services. Congregational participation in providing human services greater among worship communities that are larger, that probably doesn't surprise us, are located in low-income neighborhoods, theologically liberal, and are African-American. Supportive pastoral leadership is central. These are the findings of this report. Now, if we go to slide 26, we go to going back to that definition we gave you earlier of community development from HUD. It's pure definition. A key finding of this report is that relatively few faith-based organizations participate in community development activities. Okay, so they say, you know, we've got a lot of folks getting involved in human service, but true community development, there seems to be few. Most common are faith-based community development, or CDCs, corporations, and some national denominations and their affiliates, and Habitat for Humanity. Now, let's look at some of the reasons they cite why faith-based participation is limited, and maybe you can reflect on these based on your experiences, or you can contradict them if you don't believe they're true. But here's what we say. Congregations have two preferred approaches. They donate small amounts of cash or goods, or they provide volunteers. By contrast, community development activities require regular and sustained involvement in a range of complex processes and tasks. The next one, community development is best done by independently incorporated organizations, and establishing and fostering the growth of such organizations are the least common mode of congregational engagement. Congregational staff and volunteers typically lack skills, knowledge, and time required to successfully sponsor community development projects. Most congregations have not applied for government grants. In my experience and work with the Siouan Diaconal Conference, the Christian Reformed World Relief Committee, and Habitat and others, getting involved in taking money that has the level of management accountability that the government funding has requires a whole new level of capacity. And a lot of folks who give us money these days, donors, want us to be using it for sticks and bricks or actual program and don't like to see money lost in management. So it's a huge issue. And then we have this other point, which I think is a really important one. No existing research compares how the outcomes of community development sponsored by faith-based organizations compares with the of secular organizations. Some information is available about the challenges facing those that have tried, but little is known about the impediments faced by the minority of faith-based organizations interested in especially obtaining government funds. So these are some questions that new research ought to focus on. And then you have some implications there. Community development field needs significant technical assistance to ensure that faith-based organizations spend government funds responsibly if they're getting involved in taking government money. Faith-based organizations that want to get involved in community development may increase their effectiveness by partnering or collaborating with existing entities that are already doing this work. And then the last point they're making, there only a fraction of the organizations studied currently have resources to successfully engage in community development. However, when they do, faith-based organizations are uniquely positioned to have a significant impact beyond simply sponsoring projects. Congregations can increase public support for affordable housing and other development initiatives in their communities by engaging in dialogue and joining coalitions that support social justice. Interesting and powerful, I think, as it gives us some direction in terms of where we can be putting our energy as social workers. But it all goes on to say, you know, there's a whole lot more to know and learn. And that's a challenge that I want to leave you thinking about for those of you who are in the position to initiate research projects or to encourage people to do that, that obviously there's more work that needs to be done in that area. Now, let's leap on over to slide number 30. And this is where you're going to see a deviation from a lot of the material I've just extracted or packaged. This is just a compilation of seven proposed qualities that I'm putting out there from what I've learned and what I've read. So let's go through these and see if they resonate with you. And as you're going through this, I would hope that you think of ones that you think should be added to this list as well, because it's not intended to be comprehensive, but a place to start from. Number one, obviously, you know, is connected to and performed by the faith community and takes risks from a position of faith. I believe that there is a challenge there. If you look at what the HUD report is saying and what many of us have experienced, is that getting involved at something this deep, at this deep a level, which is different than just collecting cans of soup and vegetables and bringing them to a food pantry, requires some risk-taking. And I believe that the faith community has the opportunity to do what it does best, listen, pray, believe, and do. And so that being the first. Second is grounded in social justice with a desire to improve the quality of life in the community. A little bit harder to mobilize sometimes our congregations around the issue of social justice can be a bit of an unease and anxiety raiser for some, but definitely believe that in the end it's essential that social justice be the motivation from which we move. Many years ago, I had the opportunity to go meet with Bishop Robert Carlson of the Catholic Diocese, and was trying to engage him in working with our organization, Habitat for Humanity, and we had a really deep and meaningful conversation about housing issues and the role of the church and all of that. And he looks at me and he says, "You know, Marty, one thing that would really I'm curious about is, when are you going to stop marketing your program around being fun and romantic and exciting and help people understand that it is their responsibility from a social justice perspective to be doing this?" And it really struck me that, you know, his perception of how the organization of Habitat for Humanity is marketed is not motivated necessarily by these issues. Well, some of that may be hidden behind the back burner a little too far, but at any rate, definitely caused me to think about, you know, the work that we need to be doing to help people understand what our mandate and our calling is. Three, has a holistic focus and is development rather than charity oriented. The two main key issues there. One, the holistic focus is really about whether or not, you know, the approach we're taking seeks to address all of the issues that a person is facing, not one that's only spiritually oriented or one that's only physically oriented, the one that takes into consideration all of the needs of the individual and the community. And then the challenge, I think, that we face in the faith-based community, in my experience, is that many of us, myself included, tend to be toolbox kind of people, fix-it folk. And we see a problem, we see a challenge, and we want to go in there and fix it, and we enable in our helping rather than truly offering folks an opportunity to help themselves. And some of you may have figured out how to do this better than others, but it is a real challenge, I think, in the faith community that we carry with us. And kind of a paternalistic charity orientation goes contrary to that type of work. The next one being holds participation of and by the local community paramount. And, you know, I think that pretty well speaks for itself, but you're going to see some things coming up in some of these slides about community engagement, whether or not it's realistic, and this one, I think, is critical. Respects and builds on the gifts and strengths of the community. Models a spirit of community by collaborating with others and avoids duplication and promotes stewardship. What I'm really getting at there is that there are existing programs in place that we partner with and figure out ways of working together as opposed to creating new programs and new models just because we want to have our name, so to speak, on them. Where I did my social work field placement, I was doing crisis intervention and emergency assistance, and the community there, not all that large a community, had 7 food pantries that were going on. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out that this was happening. And I started to ask the question, what in the world is going on here? Why would we need 7 food pantries? Well, the duplication comes from the fact that, you know, many of these entities, these churches and other groups, wanted to have their own identity, and they also wanted to use the food pantry as a consumer front, in that if you get people to walk in the door to donate food to you, they'll probably write you a check and other things as well. So they were using it as a marketing means to get donors in the door. And again, you know, what does that say about our stewardship and our focus from the faith-based perspective? And then lastly, it's built on patience and perseverance and a long-term commitment. Today's, I'll just speak for, you know, us Americans, we're all about instant gratification and immediate results. And those of you who work with people know that that doesn't necessarily happen, and certainly doesn't happen in community development either. I know many groups who've tried to do work in environments overseas, and they lay out a strategic plan that says in 3 years we'll be out of here, the whole thing will be run and locally owned and operated. And 10 years later, they're still working on the first phase of their plan, and folks are disappointed. But I think there is a reality that, you know, commitment needs to be long-suffering in this particular arena. Let's jump to some models and resources, and thankfully we have Gordon here with us, so I'm actually going to tap him in just a second or two to talk a little bit about CCDA. But the first model and resource I put up on slide 31 is John Perkins, and I've got to know John through work I'd done for years back in Northwest Iowa with an organization called Justice for All. And John really promotes for us, you know, 3, I think, very clear concepts, the 3 R's of Christian community development, and those being relocation, reconciliation, and redistribution of resources. And beautiful in their form, because they really go to the heart of some of the stuff we've already talked about, being a part of the community as opposed to from the outside, and being willing to work on relationship issues, bringing people of diverse backgrounds, values together, and then really the social justice side of making sure that wealth and access to goods and resources is there through redistribution. I will say some of the first times I've written about this concepts and explored them a bit, back in my home territory, evoked letters of calling me a communist and a socialist and all of these sorts of things. But, you know, it's good stuff. John has written a number of books, and, you know, really I think the CCDA movement has kind of evolved from John's beginning work. And so, Rick, if you could you unmute it maybe, and Gordon, could you just tell us a little bit about CCDA and what you guys do? Are you there, Gordon? Has he left us? One last check. Gordon, are you there? Okay. Go ahead and mute it again, Rick, and we'll move on. There is a web address there for CCDA, and you can go there. Primarily, they do technical assistance and networking for community development work, and they have an annual conference each year as well. You can find out the timing of that. I believe it's in October this year in Atlanta on their website. But they also have some resources and materials there, and as I say at the end of the presentation, it's a great place for you to go and get started in your education process. Habitat for Humanity's website is there. I don't need to say a whole lot about that organization other than the mission statement of Habitat is really to develop communities by building and renovating houses. How well the organization has achieved that varies significantly from community to community because the focus has been primarily on the housing side. There hasn't been any work done to research and measure whether or not there's overall community impact. Some of our locations are measuring things like change in tax base, other community conditions that might be improving, but just starting to do that. So there's a lot of work to be done there in terms of whether or not Habitat's having an overall impact. If you're looking for a safe and non-threatening entree into getting into some of this community work, there is always a place for you, though, no matter what your skills or interests, in Habitat for Humanity. So I would offer that to you as a good place to start in getting yourself engaged in some of these issues, if you've not been. And the last one there, Nehemiah Plan Homes, I talked briefly about. A little project started up in Brooklyn with a group of congregations, actually one congregation in particular, and evolved into this idea of Nehemiah Plan Homes, which ended up building the 20,000 units of housing now in various locations, and has become a model that's been used in a number of places. But started with and from the IAF model of community organizing. So there's still some questions about, you know, the relevance of what they're doing in terms of how they go about it. But those four locations, and there's an article location that I've given you there on the URL that gets you in there to start with. So four possibilities. There's a whole lot more, and I'll be telling you at the end of the session how I'm working on a paper that includes all these resources. Now I'd like to take up the issue of success a bit and wrestle with that, and then we'll try to wrap up this topic and get to some questions. First, a quote there. Again, if you have come to help me, you're wasting your time, but if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. I think sets the tone, really, for how we measure and define success and whether or not we realize that if a community is to be healthy and whole, it means that everyone in the community is contributing and everyone in the community is experiencing the joys of their contribution and the results. Determining what to assess can be a challenge. Looking at change over time requires the patience and the tenacity and the resources to do longitudinal studies. A lot of the studies that we do tend not to be longitudinal simply because, you know, of the commitment there. And in this case, as you know, our bottom line is both social and economic. So measuring financial change in the business sector with that kind of bottom line can be fairly straightforward compared to what we're trying to do in terms of measuring social change. Screen 33 gives you some additional ideas on things to look at in terms of indicators of success. Let's just run through these, and then I will ask you when we break next time for your thoughts and ideas on additional indicators of success. So be thinking about the ones that are missing. First, physical changes in buildings, parks, lots, streets, and infrastructure. Kind of that windshield survey type of stuff. If I can walk down the street or drive in my car and I start to see change, I can count fewer broken windows. I can count painted buildings. I can count parks and so forth. The next being the increase in property taxes that are being generated by the property there. That's a fairly easy one to measure in a geographic boundary community. Reduction in nuisance abatement and crime events. These things are measurable. Reduced homelessness, health problems, things of that nature. Whether or not the local leadership is involved in owning decisions and making the decisions, or if those are still being made by people outside of the community. And increased linkages and social networks are being reported by people who live there. There are qualitative ways to assess that as well. But I think in the faith-based community development side, there's a whole other dimension to assessing success that we need to take a look at, and that is whether or not for the faith-based entities themselves, are the members of a congregation, for example, more engaged, giving more time, talent, and tithe than we did before? Are people, getting a sense of their being able to bring reality to the rhetoric and doing something about their commitment and their talk on a given week? So there's, I think, an opportunity there for us to develop a whole new set of measures and look at ways in which faith-based entities themselves, churches, congregations, synagogues, and others are finding change within their own community because of the work they're doing in community development efforts. So please be thinking about other indicators, and we'll bring that up at our next break. Now let's take a look at this question of local engagement. How true to form is it in practice? And this is a document I was referencing earlier, this industry note called Issues in Nonprofit Community Development. It's put out by the Kennedy School and done by Alex Van Hoffman here at the Joint Center for Housing Studies. And he goes on to say, ask the question, are community-based organizations truly community-based? Articles in the news media and community development public relations materials frequently suggest that community development groups are grassroots indigenous organizations that express the aspirations of low-income residents of the inner city. Although small groups of local activists start or are sponsored many community development organizations as a rule, they're neither democratic or indigenous. The people who manage community-based organizations and their projects differ from the most of their constituents in education, occupational level, and not even frequently neighborhood of residence. Which takes us right back to the John Perkins' first R of the three R's being relocation, or being a part of the community in which you're engaging. And so that same document also has in it some additional thoughts about, the value of community organizing versus community development and so forth. But just an interesting remark, I think, to take us back to the success question and how difficult it can be to truly be doing community development. And then a bit more about this community organizing issue, and one of the two books I mentioned earlier, Faith in Action, Richard Wood says, community organizing typically describes work inspired by the Dean of Community Organizers, Saul Alinsky. Although faith-based organizing remains rather unknown in academic circles, the first nationwide study of the field shows it to be second in size only to the labor movement among drives for social justice among low-income Americans. 133 local or metropolitan area federations linking some 3,500 congregations, 500 schools, local labor unions, and other institutions. Faith-based organizing can plausibly claim to touch the lives of some 2 million members of these institutions in all major urban areas and many secondary cities around the U.S. So community organizing from the faith-based realm have, according to Richard Wood, engaged a lot of people, and I think is something to pay attention to as well. Then just a quote here to wrap up topic two, coming from the book Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. Although Americans are by and large affluent beyond the dreams of the rest of the world, many of us have lost something invaluable, belonging to a community. The presence of community is a powerful reminder that authentic wealth does not consist in the size of one's bank account, but in the depth and diversity of relationships within the community. The mechanic that won't overcharge you, the neighbor you can trust your kids with, the landscape and other creatures so familiar that you know you are home.